Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the MSU Libraries Colloquia event, Bauhaus in a Barrel by Luis Delgado Qualtro. I'm Hui Hua Chua, the MSU Libraries Liaison to the School of Journalism. The MSU Library is very proud to own two works by Mr. Delgado Qualtro. One of them, the artist book Cuentos Chinos, attributed to Dr. Achu, is on view at the MSU Museum as part of the exhibition Seeing China in Photographic Views and Viewpoints. And we also have his other work here that's available for viewing tonight as well, Loteria Cosmologica. Okay. Our speaker's presence tonight was made possible by the MSU School of Journalism, the MSU Museum, the Department of History, the Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Affairs, Asian Studies Center, the MSU Honors College, and Global Studies in the Arts and Humanities. Thank you to all those departments and programs for their support. Dr. Howard Boson from the School of Journalism has been instrumental in facilitating Lewis's presence tonight. I will now turn it over to him to introduce our speaker.
Thank you. Before I introduce Luis, I do want to mention that the Seeing China Photographic Views and Viewpoints exhibition at the MSU Museum will be on view through the end of August. If you haven't seen it, it's worth going over and looking at. And that Luis is the second of three photographers we've been able to invite. The third photographer, Stephen Benson, will be on campus giving a public lecture at 3 o'clock on Monday, April 13th, in 145 Comm Arts. Luis's photographic work integrates narrative and sequential still images to create idea-driven content that answers what cannot be answered and to answer what cannot be questioned. His work has evolved from documentary to a more personal style using humor and constructed images which reflects his Mexican origins and his European humanist education with an American quest for the new. His works have been exhibited worldwide, and his prints and artist books have been widely exhibited and are held by many museums, institutions, and private collectors. Some of the public collections where his work can be found are the San Francisco Museum of Fine Art, the Museum of Fine Art Houston, the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas Austin, the Stanford University Libraries, the Zollner Art Center at Lehigh University, in our own Michigan State University libraries, the University of California, the Mexican Museum in San Francisco, and FOCO in the Bronx, the Musette for Fotokunst in Denmark, the Bibliothèque Nationale, the Musée d'Arte Moderno de Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and the list goes on. So with that brief introduction, I'm sure you'd all rather hear from Luis than me. So I'm going to turn it over to Luis, and we're going to see if we're getting a signal. What happened here? There we go.
There we go.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank, definitely my host, Mr. Benson, Ms. Kathy, and the institution, which it's amazing what institutions can do if you can get into them. It's great. And it's, here I come back and I visit an old friend, which if they've made a little box for it, which is very nice to see. But it's a curious world. I think there's only one person who probably doesn't know what the Bauhaus is. Does everybody knows. And I believe it's the young lady, because I'm afraid I'm dating myself when I use those kinds of things, and I will be using those kinds of references throughout the lecture because I'm, as you can tell, I've sort of gained a little bit of experience as I'm going along. But anyway, so the Bauhaus in a Barrel, I'll finish that later on. You'll get the whole story later on. But it is an interesting thing. It was curious to see in class earlier on I said, well, does anybody know where the Bauhaus is? And nobody says, well, you're looking at it. And everybody was looking at their computer. And I said, good design, form follows function. That's where it comes from. But nobody knew that. So I come from Mexico City, which is one of the oldest cities in this continent. And this is a view which I've sort of messed around with of the back part of Mexico City with the torn-down temple of Tenochtitlan, which now has been reconstructed into the cathedral, the National Palace, and many other things. This is a view that's taken from a little museum that is the Museum of the Archive of Photography for the City of Mexico. And just by chance, a friend of mine that runs it now, and he says, come on, let's go up on the roof. I've got something to show you. And this is what he showed me. And I was able to create a fun composite out of that. But Mexico City is, I have a love-hate relationship with the place. It's a hard place to be. When I was in Buenos Aires once, I asked, what's the population of Argentina? And they said, oh, about 20 million. I said, well, that's what's in my neighborhood. You know, 20-odd million people, 25. Luckily, we're not as big as Chongqing, which has 35 million. But it feels like it sometimes. Interesting city. I don't know if you ever go. It's fascinating. And what I have particularly started to enjoy is to go downtown. I found this little hotel, which cost me $45 a night. Clean, simple, and I can get out and walk, and I am in the 15th century, 16th century, like that, you know. And then if I want to be, I can be in the 20th century in a 10-minute, you know, 21st century in a 10-minute cab ride, which I really enjoy. Whoops, it fell asleep. I guess I'm putting it to sleep. Come on, here we go. My grandfather is from this area, so I'm going back. It's fine. I'm going back often because I'm working on a series of books about my origins, of my family origins, and trying to make a good, compelling story, which is not about me, really. It's more about the human endeavor of survival and getting ahead. You know, all these, I think we all share stories of that in our family history. So of how the grandparents did this, how they survived the Depression, how they survived the Mexican Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the World War, the Holocaust. So that's things that really interest me. As you can tell, I do like history. And therefore, I enjoy the institutions that can preserve it and keep it so that we can reference it. I grew up with this kind of stuff. On Saturdays afternoons in Mexico City, we would go down to the post office, which is a great post office. It's built by Porfirio Diaz, by an Italian. It's an Italian building that is brass and marble and faux marble. It's just incredible. If you ever go to Mexico City, I recommend you go to the post office. But this photograph is at the top is a mural at the San Francisco Art Institute that is done by Diego Rivera. And he lived a couple blocks away from my house, where I grew up, from the house I grew up in Mexico City. And I hear tales of him coming knocking on the door looking for a sandwich, but I think he was looking for female company for my mom, knowing who he was. But anyway, it's nice. But this is the kind of things that we grew up. And often enough, we would go downtown, and my father always enjoyed going to pyramids and going out to, he was very proud of his native culture. He was obviously a Mexican of mixed heritage in terms of, you know, Spanish and Indian. And he was very proud of that and instilled this in us to go out. We had, you know, large archaeological collection. We would always go out looking around for pottery shards and stuff. And one of the things we would go was go watch Diego Rivera paint the murals in the National Palace. So this was the view that I was familiar with. And when I went back to the Art Institute, I got to see this mural. And I, every time I go to the Art Institute, which is quite frequently, I always go say hello, pay homage to him. And the bottom photograph is a photograph of Diego Rivera's hands, done in marble, at the on his tomb, and it has the irises, and that's it. The cemetery of the illustrious. There used to be the cemetery of the illustrious men, but now they've including women, so it's the illustrious Mexicans. Tina Modotti is on the other side of the fence, but it's another great place to go and watch. And especially if you like sculpture, memorial sculpture, which I enjoy doing. Mexico, well, it's a crazy country, you know. Folk art is everywhere. It has a culture of double entendre jokes, playing around. There was a golden age of cinema, which seems to have come back. But now we're not doing Mexican movies, we're doing Hollywood movies. But it's still very interesting. And this is things that we live with and grew up with. You know, fantasies and silly things. Now, again, I'm going to ask, who knows what this is? This is from Blow Up. You know, from a great movie. This is what I, one of the things that inspired me to become a photographer was to see in that film, and also the fact that my dad turned up one day with a Zeiss Icon Contaflex that he'd quote unquote found in an airplane. And it was in a nice brown case. So I got curious, and that's what I did. I also had the opportunity to study at the tutelage of a great man who really was my putative father, Frank Gonzalez, an American who was born, Mexican-American, who was born in Pasadena and came to Mexico on the GI Bill. And he started in art school. And we would go and we could do theater, we could do painting, we could do, he had a loft, yeah. But he was of a Quaker origin. Quaker upbringing, so everybody had to clean up after himself and take care of that, which in a country where you have maids is highly unusual. So self-sufficiency was something that he really instilled in us. And we had a great time. It was great. So Mr. Hemming, thank you. I started out as many photographers do, which is just going out there and taking pictures and documenting and recording. Mexican photography at that time was highly centered on documenting its own culture. It was not photography which involved an inner search. It was just a search of and a documentation. I worked as an archaeological photographer on several digs. My uncle was an archaeologist. I remember going as a kid working on a dig where he was digging up a mastodon. Anyway, but that's, you know, so I walk around. It's something I still do. I walk around and I kick rocks over and I'm always looking to see what's on the ground and I take pictures of it now. This is Chichen Itza, which is one of the largest cities in Yucatan Peninsula, and we went out there on several seasons and just had to catalog carved rocks. So we'd go out in the middle of the night because we were using a flash, and we, you know, bas relief and high relief rocks. So we would go out there like, you know, Buana and his porters, and go out there and lift rocks and number them, photograph them, put them into the archive. It was not an easy job, but it was good fun. I don't think I would do it now. And there I started doing more of these portraits. This is from another site in Campeche, is a Temple B in Rio Bec, where I start doing these portraits, which I, until not many years later, I compiled into a portfolio, which I called Ojos que no ven, eyes that see, eyes that see, hearts that do not feel. Go out there and put your camera in front of people was something that we could do. I don't think I could do this again. I'd probably get a bullet between the head these days. Which is great fun is to watch the shoelaces of these guys. I'd go out to the nightclubs and photograph my colleagues and have a good time. You know, some of these are from that series are in the SF MoMA. I stopped doing that and concentrated on doing commercial photography and trade, and then came up to the United States, went to the Art Institute for a short time. It was not for me. And then worked as a commercial photographer, as an assistant, and then a commercial photographer, and which was a great experience because it was when the computers started. And I got to photograph the launching of Apple and IBM products. The computer revolution was us, and we were thrilled with it. And now we look at it and go, oh dear. But it's an incredible experience. Then I got tired of doing commercial photography and tried to regain my documentary roots. And I went back to an area of Mexico where they do Mardi Gras in a very interesting way. And I compiled these works. And this is, you know, Mardi Gras is, finally someone told me, you know, Mardi Gras is like an organized revolution. Everybody can go crazy. The order is subverted for a couple days, and then it's returned. You know, so it is sort of like the first, one of the most important little revolutions that happens. And obviously, it's a time when you can make fun of people and get away with it. And here they're dressed up as Englishmen, where they're. The English built the railroads in Mexico, and in this particular area they went through. So they pick up and they dress up as, in Brits with the umbrellas and stuff. Another horse people, you know, and they go up and down the street singing ribald songs, and so on and so forth. But I went to PhotoFest. And which is this great, it's been, it sort of sounds like trite, I repeat it and repeat it, but PhotoFest has been seminal in my photographic career because it's a platform where you can go and do speed dating with your pictures and curators and collectors and other people who are interested. And you can get and go show your work for 4 or 5 days, and it's exhausting. And if you're not doing too well, it can be very debilitating. And when I went with this work, I had this in the deck, which wasn't quite as elaborate as it is now. And it wasn't connecting, and I realized that I was not a documentary photographer anymore. I did not enjoy being involved in that world, which is, in a lot of these Mardi Gras, is the world of consumption of alcohol, getting drunk, and in some places, it's they use muskets. And I know what being shell-shocked is. You are in a crowd where 200 or 300 muskets are going off at the same time, and it just hits you in the chest, and it's like you go nuts. It's really so. I stopped doing this kind of work. It's fun. I mean, here, this is very Mexican. They're dressed as, the main man in white suit was dressed as one of the presidents. That's Salinas de Gortari, who's one of the most wealthiest men in the world at the moment. And through another project I did with which is another story, I learned how the origins of this mask, which everybody knows now, you know, especially through that, what we call a churro movie, a bad movie, the Nacho Libre movie, which I think it's not very good. But this thing about the mask, and it's ironic that the mask that the Mexican wrestlers are known for was invented by an Irishman named Jim McKay. And he went to a shoemender and asked him to make a mask out of leather, and he wore it once, and it was very uncomfortable. And they finally settled on gabardine. And now it's that. Not many people know that, how the origin of the mask that is brought. It's an Irishman. Anyway, so I stopped with this, and I reinvented myself. But before that, I had to find my voice. And that was an interesting process. It was a lot of fun. I'm obviously the guy on the right. And where I came up was with this icon and thought, where I started associating photographs with thoughts and putting them into a game. And I was able to tag them, you know, put the words onto the image themselves based on a Mexican game of the Loteria, which is a very simple game. It's a game of bingo for literate people, people who can't read. And so they use very simple, straight one-liner imagery. It's like the parrot, the bottle, the drunk man, the ladder, things like that. But what I was attempting, where I became aware that was the challenge was there, was to attempt to get not only one reading, two readings, three readings, and maybe, luckily, a fourth. And then when you associate them all, it really is fun. And I will show you later on how I play it. It has taken me 20 years to figure out how to play that thing comfortably, because you can get yourself in trouble when you're starting to tell people, well, you're not doing too good or whatever. You'll see. So there are 41 cards. The original is silver gelatin prints mounted on two-ply board with a paper backing, and each one was hand-stamped. So there was a high percentage of garbage, because they would smudge or not write. So, and you know, I still like this. It's a great project. So there's the 41 cards, and you know, they talk about religion, politics, sexuality, pain, family. You know, it brings in, and the way I came up with it, I had this Argentinian friend who killed himself recently. Where we would sit around a cup of tea and discuss philosophy and discuss the psychology behind the game. And he was much more complicated than I was. I kept it rather simple. And I came up with the five main attributes, which what everybody has. Everybody has obstacles. Everybody has doubts, aspirations, desires. And then you have to have a denouement, a way to get out. So you will come up with the vehicle, the way out. So those are the five. And then once that fell in place, all the other ones were easy. You know, the rule, obviously, since it's based on photographs, it has to be a good photograph, has to be an intriguing photograph. There are no living people in here. They're all the mark of man somehow, or a representation, a sculpture, a poster, a painting, a situation. So I came up with the brown box is the original, and then I did a digital version, which makes it easier to produce and makes it affordable to make, because the original box is very expensive to make, and it's not easy. So this was my break in my career, and it was fortunate, and it was really due to PhotoFest that I was able to produce that. Then I did, same time I started doing work on issues, political issues. So it's capital crimes and Old Smoky. And Old Smoky, if you're from the South, know what it is. It's the electric chair in Huntsville in Texas. And my mother's from Texas, and she had gone to a debating society state competition in Huntsville. And they did that. And part of the thing of the event was a tour of the jail and a tour of the execution room, and they were offered to be able to see who wanted to sit on Old Smoky. So that was that. And there was a tale my mother told me. And then I had a paid gig to do an educational project out in Huntsville. And I got to go out there, fly out there, and I went to the State Correction Museum, and there was Old Smoky. So that inspired me, and that brought me back. And it was at the same time a man had been executed in Florida in the electric chair, and he'd caught fire as he was being executed. So I created these panels. There are four panels, and each one has two crimes and two punishments that are associated with that, which is from adultery to murder and lovely things, genocide. But it's a way where I started working with icons, you know, treason, infanticide, rape, and with the associated punishment that came with it. So that was that. I guess this was my dark period. Then 9/11 came along, and that whole era of that we're still seeing. And I did this body work called Circumstance and Volition, which is nurture or culture. And obviously, I also, the internet was very new to me, and I was able to appropriate and steal and slurp a large amount of imagery, and I would go out and research large amount of imagery and start collecting it. It's my scrapbook. And I did this body work, and this is I don't know if you remember, a Saudi princess who had been beaten on her maid and had been arrested, but she got let out pretty quickly since she's Saudi and we get along so well with the Saudis. So I created more concentrated panels, and there are two of them. And this is Colombian policemen who were killed in a drug war. And if you know the story of Patrick Henry, those are his feet. And it's actually in Chicago in front of the Hearst building, isn't it? That's a sculpture. Yeah. And so that's what I photograph. And these are various bad guys, mostly political, with that. So I did that. And then I ended it with this one, which is called September Song. And it's just, and in here you'll find Shimon, you have, oh dear, a bunch of great people. From Dai, Princess Dai, it was whoever was happening at the time that was coming in the media stream, you know. Michael Jackson, Bin Laden, Bin al-Shibi, Daniel Pearl, and so on and so forth. So I did this. Then again, in Houston, I ran across these colossal heads of American presidents. And they're colossal. As Texas likes them, big. And I started messing around with them. So again, paraphrasing history, and I made this project called Power Ties, which here's where I start realizing that I can do other things with the imagery besides just making wall stuff, and you'll see it a little bit later on what I do with this. Obviously, I embrace the digital revolution, and I am allowed to do work that these collages and things like that, which would have been very difficult to do in another way, and I'm able to do them here with the digital thing, and I really enjoy that. I'm getting back into more purist work now, but again, another body of work. These large scrolls, large prints, a little bit larger than life size, of different things that I found throughout the world, and I collage them together, which is based on a game, a surrealist game of, they call it Exquis, Exquisite Corpse. As a child, you folded picture and you passed it on and you create another story. So these are two, imagery from a lot of cemeteries and heroic places and posters, or just plain old, different things that you run across in the world. I got to travel through South America several times on gigs, and I obviously went to look at the cemeteries there. And there's, in Buenos Aires, there's two cemeteries that are very well known. One is Recoleta, which is close to downtown, and then there's the big one, which is Cacharita. And my friend says, well, Cacharita is like Venice, but it's not flooded. And you go there, and it's just these wonderful monuments of in marble and bronze and stuff. And they have one of Jorge Newbery. And Jorge Newbery is an English Argentinian who was the first aviator in Argentina. And you go to that, and it's a whole corner of a city with the representations of the Cordillera, with these condors on the top, with a twice size life angel broken on the bottom with a broken wing. And highly dramatic as they are. Great, great stuff. And I had fun with those. This is in Denmark, and people think I went and taped these guys up, but this is Roosevelt, as we know. But that was what I found. I don't usually mess around with things that I found on the street. I just let them speak by themselves. So what I did here was to take them out of context and strengthen the thing. Dane is Copenhagen. Again, regarding looking at monuments in their shadow. This is from Texas, San Jacinto Battleground. My mom used to ride a horse through there, delivering newspapers with her shotgun that was given to her when she was 15. Texas. Gardel, famous tango singer. This is Chacarita, so if you go there, go look for him. Then Wendy Watrous comes again and says, I've got a project for you. Wendy Watrous is the director of PhotoFest, the creative director. She says, I got a project. So she calls this a call for entry, and it's artists responding to violence. And I come up with this. Unfathomable humanity. It's the lovely things we do to each other as human beings. Again, as you notice, I like to use aliases. And in this case, it's Liz Dibertus. She got upset about that, but we finally came to an agreement. And Liz Dibertus is based on Gislibertus. Gislibertus was the first sculptor to sign his sculptures on the facades of medieval or Gothic, medieval churches in northern France. And since I'm Luis, I changed it around. As a good Mexican, I changed it into Liz Dibertus. So, io somo Liz Dibertus. And this piece is called Empire. It's a critique of what happens with many countries when they start expanding and encroaching on their neighbors and on the other parts of the world. In this case, it's America, the United States. So we have the dishonor of Abu Ghraib with American presence and the taking of the storming of the Chapultepec Castle in the War of 1842. But I'm an equal abuser. Everybody gets tacked on. I did 14 plates. I do the church. I do everything. So I'm just going to show you a few. This is the Argentinian Dirty War. Where women were picked up off the street or signaled out and picked up by black falcons, which were really green, but I didn't know that until I went back. But the Secret Service drove around in falcons, Ford falcons, and would pick them up and disappear in different ways. And they were taken to the ESMA, which is the Navy school, mechanical school, and held and tortured and eventually disappeared. So the angel that is falling represents the women who were pregnant and held until they gave birth. And then the children were adopted into good Christian families, good military families, and then were given the last flight over the South Atlantic, dragged and thrown out the airplane. On the right is the people who did it. And on the left, those are the ones who we know suffered from that. So we have, and these are all well-researched. There's a guide to this. I forget people's names after some time, but most, if you wanted to know, I could tell you who's who. This one's called Arms for the Poor. People who deal in manufacture or invent arms, weapons, and profit from them somehow. The man who invented the Uzi, the man who invented the Colt revolver, man who invented the Kalashnikov, people who have dealt, who deal in selling arms in large quantities or profit from their position in the military to go out and make money afterwards, like Mr. Halliburton, or then there's Menin in Argentina who was doing deals with the Iranians. So, lovely people. This one's called Hiroshima Mon Amour. People who innocently or not innocently contributed to the use of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We have Niels Bohr, Madame Curie, Einstein, and other Oppenheimer, people, and the two bombs. Mm-hmm. The Inquisition. Pope Pacelli, who facilitated the Nazis to get out of Germany and into South America at the end of the war. Richelieu, the war against the Huguenots. We have many examples that are based on the Inquisition. Oops. This is the other side, the jihad, people who did the 9/11 event, the murder of Daniel Pearl in Pakistan with his child bomber, who was actually, from what I understand, this was done in Germany, and they actually prosecuted the father for doing this photograph. This is Black Ravens, people who contributed to the Gulag in the Soviet Union, and the Black Ravens are the black cars that they picked the Cheka would pick you up in. The Cheka became the KGB, and now it's the SFB. So, delivery systems and how I learned to love artist books. I like military history, and I like the concept of being able to have a package to deliver something. And by accident, or by fortuitous luck, a friend of mine, Steve Woodall, from the San Francisco Center for the Book, said, that's an artist book. I said, well, okay. I never knew what an artist book was. And he said, I'm going to show that in New York. And I said, okay. And I became more engaged with it through time. And then I realized that there was a commercial benefit also, and also not only a commercial benefit, but a benefit of being able to package or make a delivery system of my work in another way that could be used by other people and placed and can engage a different audience. So I borrowed this line from Mr. Kubrick, which I think is one of the greatest films that I really enjoyed. I think it was the last film my mother saw. After that, she said, I'm not going to movies again. So I came up, and then I start packaging the work into books. And I don't like to make my life complicated, but I do. And I use prefabricated things. So I did Unfathomable Humanity and this Masonite book, portfolio book, which I, when it's brand new, it was really important for me because you open up the little plastic bag and it smells like bureaucracy. And that's what I wanted, that this thing had a bureaucratic feel and thing. One of the great things about books is you don't have to plug them in and they don't tattle as Big Brother does through this. Here's another one, is Deconstitution by Cedric Tapantotoli, again, a nickname. This was based on what Dick Cheney and George Bush were trying to do with the Constitution at the time. And it was for a call for entry on a book, on a show on banned books, because there is banned book. As good librarians, you must know there's a banned book day, which we must keep alive to protect that. It was very simple. Here we go, is Power Ties, going back. I really realized that I could make lemonade out of my lemons in different ways. This is the installation of the Power Ties of the American presidents. When you walked in on the left-hand side, there was a poem, a written poem by Shelley, Ozymandias, which really lovely little poem, speaks about the non-eternity of things and how everything gets swept in the sands of time. And at the rear, there is a mirror and a little rug that you can stand on and look, and then you can look at yourself, and you're surrounded by these heads of these people. And then I decided to make it into a book, and I was able to make this accordion, and then you open it up. You know, there's the poem, well, there's a titled poem, and you open it up, and at the bottom, there's a mirror, and you can see yourself. So the experience of the installation was kept. The spirit of that was kept in there. And then I have Chinese Tales by Dr. Achu, again. People ask me, well, why are they like that? And it's, well, China has always had a fascination to me. China, we lived with China, and Mexico was the bridge between China and Europe for 200-300 years. The China, the galleon, would come to Acapulco from Manila. The
load the silk and spices overland to Veracruz, and then they'd go into Seville. It all had to go into Seville. And so there is this contact. And I always, well, come on, who doesn't have a fascination with China, you know? Once you're there, it's a different story. And then we always went. So finally, my wife Marlita and I made it there. We always wanted to go early, a long time ago. And I started going out, and you know, the great thing is, I went with. We organized a little group, so we had a tour guide for us, a little van, and you know they would go ahead, and I'm always in the back shooting pictures and. The tour guide was worried about me. He says, no worry, he'll catch up. This is what he always does. So, you know, it was great. And I didn't have to worry about where I was going to sleep, where I was going to eat, anything. I just needed to take pictures and enjoy and experience the country and the intenseness of millions of billions of people. Then I came back, and I had these photographs. And I've always sort of liked the negative. The negative gives you a different thing. And then I said, well, where's China? China's right down there, under there. It's so I'm going to do it reverse, you know. So that's part of the reason why this is a negative, because it's on the other side of the world. It's totally silly, but that's who I am. And it comes with aphorisms, comes with all these little things, and I try to tie. You know, a concept to an image. But again, what really is important here is the image. Obviously, the fold-up is very related to Chinese artwork and things. So that was, and Dr. Achu, I don't know where that came from. Oh, I know where it comes from. Dr. Abu, I went to Singapore once, and there used to be this great, great amusement park by, it's called the Tiger Balm Gardens, which has been destroyed. It was built by Dr. Aboum. And Dr. Aboum, you must probably be aware of, is the guy who made his fortune with Tiger Balm. So that's where Dr. Achu comes from. And I go to these places because they have their three-dimensional stories of Chinese tales and fables, and they're great, and I've used them all the time. Then I did this other one. I've done many other ones, but I'm just showing you a few. This is one which was a call for a show in San Antonio on the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution and Mexican independence, the 200th anniversary. So I did this thing called Famous Mexican Phrases, compiled by Heinz Clickworth. And it's a fold-up of mostly appropriate imagery and definitely appropriated words. I'm quoting, this is a governor, one of the wealthiest men in Mexico, who's created the political group that right now controls the Mexican president, who is as corrupt as they can get. And his quote, which the president lives by, is a poor politician indeed is a poor politician. And there's another Mexican president who said, dog with bone in the mouth does not bark, nor does he bite. So if you give him a bone, he's on your side. There's Yes Ordaz. It was very interesting. You start looking into archives and you find imagery that you could never imagine that it existed. He is the man who ordered the massacre of the students in Tlatelolco in 1968, where the army went into a demonstration and just killed, I don't know how many hundreds of people. And he says, hate was not born within me. As a justification. This is a famous labor leader, La Huera Alcaine. He ran the electricians union. And he says, the trick is not to pee, but to make a lot of foam. This was Roberto Madrazo. It was a presidential candidate. Women are not washing machines, even though they look like them. And I just play on that. I mean, this is just great material to have fun in. And I, you know, I rent Mexican movies or whatever I need to, I'll just go and look for it and I photograph it and build it. And I make small editions, so I don't worry too much about copyright. I just have fun. Then I did this one recently, it's called I Sing for Brad. I said I wouldn't make complicated books, but this one's a very complicated one. It's a bifold, which allows you to read in many different levels, and it's about street people and poetry that I wrote. You can open it and combine imagery in different levels. And it took me like 15 years to finally be able to digest the material and find a voice that I didn't find to be patronizing or lamenting or anything. It just speaks, in my opinion, speaks rather nicely to the thing. Then the last big book I did, this is 47 Diaries. These are the diaries of my wife's aunt, who was born in Wiesbaden and got out in early 30s to Luxembourg. And the first diary is from 1929. The last diary that's compiled in here is 2009. And it traces her life through her mussings and questions, through her handwriting, her collection of little pictures, her doodles, and objects that she had. This is a 20 by 24 book. It's large. A friend of mine named Warren Padula always told me, he says, it's always kind of good to come and go to a portfolio review with something big. It's like if you go to a diplomatic negotiation and you have an aircraft carrier parked out off the coast, they pay attention to you. So, odd illusion. But anyway, the diaries. I got to meet, the story of a lady that's pretty amazing. Survived the war, they ran an underground railroad, then she ends up in England, through many other stories that I could spend a long time sharing with you, but I won't. And in England, she educates herself. She gets a doctorate in philosophy and a doctorate in economics at LSE. And from there, she starts consulting for a lot of governments in Latin America on oil policy. She's brought to Mexico by Luis Echeverria, who was a president, to create an institute. And then she starts working with the diplomatic service in Mexico on training their diplomatic corps in philosophy, art history, table manners, everything. And she does tell a great story about when the wall came down in Eastern Europe, that the Czechs, well, the Czechoslovakian at the time, the embassy asked her to come because they could bring out the good silverware and the good plates and the fancy glassware, and they didn't know how to use it. So she was able to tell them that this fork goes here and that knife goes there and this, that kind of stuff. A woman of culture and a great appreciation of culture and of herself. So she tells me and says, look, I've got these diaries that I've been writing and I'd like them to be kept somewhere. What can I do? And I said, I really don't know. But through the years, I finally figured out how to place them. And now they're at Stanford, which brings a lot of joy to her, that her diaries are open for research. They're very personal, but she's happy with that. The diaries at first are very you know, young woman, young girl, but at the end, that's where she's attached to it, because there are philosophical musings about God and existence, and she definitely gets into it. This is my latest little book, which is what I call a livre trouvé, a found book. And there is a tradition I've just realized of making book objects. So this little teapot was given to my daughter as a kid, as young, and it was on its way to the free box. And my wife put it in front of me, and I think she knew what I was gonna do. So I said, okay, well, I came up. So this is Changqing, Mao Zedong and Bo Xilai's wife, you know, Tempest. You know, so it's a silly illusion. But at the same time, I have fun. After all that horror and stuff, you gotta go and try to do something else. Also, it's work for the market. Not everybody wants to buy murder and mayhem. They want to have a little beauty in it. So I go to the farmer's market and collect fruits and veggies. And I try to cook them, but sometimes it doesn't work. This is from a coffee shop where I used to go to. And it was right on the counter. And I said, excuse me, I need to borrow that. I'll be back in a couple hours. And it's great. Friends bring me things. They know my penchant, so. My friend Henry Cam always has brought this and a good tomato. This is a Buddha hand lemon. Then I find, I like to work in my garden, and there's always little pieces of wood laying around. So there's a piece that I did called Ode to Spring. A great portrait of a non-existing person. A beautiful little print. Here is, again, the going. Here is trying to get into the visuals of drawing the eye, amusing the eye, and engaging it, and making it go around and round and round, and with a little silly game in the back of the head. This one's called Shimmer from the series of Amuse-Bouche, which are little tiny, hors d'oeuvres. Usually my bodies of work go 15, not more than 20 images per body of work. I'm just showing small samples. Use the peaches that I found at the end there. And then recently, I just did this a couple weeks ago. I looked at these glass negatives, and I looked at the back of them. And I've always been enthralled by the negative. And if you look at a negative and you turn it into light a certain way, you can see the three-dimensionality of the emulsion. And especially with these old glass plates, these are from Peru, these were from the collection of Fernando Castro. And we're publishing these. But I asked him, I said, can I photograph these like that? Because this is what I want to look at, just the emulsions. So I found a way to light them and then correct the perspective afterwards, which gives you another sense of the portrait. It's a different kind of a portrait. And it's just nice to look at. Here's a highly pitted glass plate, probably mushrooms growing on it. And sometimes it goes as far as where you basically can't recognize that there's an image there of a person. So once again, one must reinvent oneself to keep oneself fresh. So what I'm doing now is I created this company with my wife, Malulu. Malulu people are always curious, well, where does Malulu come from? Well, Malulu comes from the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. We were there a long, long, long time ago. And they had a program where they would take two photographs of our images from two people and then blend it to the computer program. So we had to come up with a file name. And her name is Marlita. And in some circles, I'm known as Uncle Lulu. So she made Malulu. And then when I was started to create this publishing firm, I said, can I use Malulu? And she said, it took a little convincing. But she finally gave it to me. And then, lo and behold, I researched, and what does Malulu mean? Nothing, nothing, nothing. Now I have a large following of the Malulu family in Tanzania. They don't quite know what to make of me. So it's like, oh yeah, one's a police chief, and oh dear. But anyway, what I do, really my mission is, as it says here, Malulu Editions publishes artistic work of unique cultural significance and focuses on work of the 20th century and contemporary North and Latin American. I make portfolio editions of photographers that from my generation, the early works of what I'm doing. John O'Leary, an American who moved to Mexico in 1969, never came back, photographed Mexican wrestling, and has photographed this town of Cholula. So I've got three more projects with him, one on country weddings, and then another one on the religious rituals of this town, which is extremely interesting. I'm going to do another one with a Chilean photographer, Julio Donoso, when he started photographing on horse racing in Europe, Chantilly and London and Ascot. You know, that kind of stuff. Also with a Palestinian photographer named Said Nusbai, who photographed with a Fulbright scholarship most of the temples and mosques in the Middle East and in Syria, which have been destroyed now. So it's a way to preserve our cultural tradition and hopefully place it in institutions that will take care of it and preserve it. And that is something that it's very important to me. And I enjoy doing it. Other projects. We're doing another one with lowriders, Mexican circus. I just don't have time or the funds to do all the ones I want, so I do what I jump off what I can, and also do my own projects. So, yes, we go back to that, the Bauhaus in the Barrel. This is an interesting story, which really encapsulates what I've been talking about. I had the fortune of going to a school where it was the French Lycée in Mexico City. And one of my schoolmates, who had very big ears, his mom would take him back. His name was Jan van Buren, van Buren. And, you know, I'd go to his house, and it was a very interesting house, very modern. I really don't know what it was. Later on, I find out that Mike, his father, had studied at the Bauhaus before the war, and that one of his buddies was a man who came from Chicago, and this guy had gotten in trouble with the Nazi party, and they came to pick him up. But he wasn't there. So they put him in a barrel, him and another guy, and took him to Sweden. And that was Bertrand Goldberg, who built Marina Towers and the hospital. So in a way, and then Mike lived in Mexico and made great furniture, modern furniture. And he built a house in Mexico that was the first Bauhaus house. The 40s. So it was great. So to me, it's like, you know, it's these chance encounters where you can stow away something and make it survive and pull it and then it open it up and it flourishes into something else. That's what is important to me. So Bertrand, I guess you must know who he is. Great architect. So I'll leave you with this. Yeah, I don't know. You find these things out there. So thank you. Any questions?
Were you going to show folks that?
Yeah, I need a victim. I mean, a volunteer. Madam, come on, Therese. Yes. Come look. So, this is the way it works. And the librarian's gonna kill me. No, I need my victim on that side. And we will not handle them too much. I usually shuffle them, but since this is... So, what I have here are five main attributes. The obstacles, the doubts, the aspirations, the desires, and the vehicle, which we all share. Now, it took me a long time to be able to read this correctly, because it's hard to deal with people's deeper fears and feelings and stuff. So I came up with this clause. It's only good for 10 minutes, okay? So it's the disclaimer. Whatever's here just happened, and it's with good fun. And then other times I get myself in a pinch, in a tight corner, and other tarot readers have showed me how to get out of that, which is very interesting. So please draw one for each one in sequence.
Okay.
We must engage the element of chance.
So I set this here?
You set it, yeah. Basically face down.
Oh, is it two?
Yeah, that's one. And that's it.
That's it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is the instruction.
Okay.
Very well. So the obstacles, I've got the interlude. It's a picture of the devil that I found in Spain. And she drew, ladies and gentlemen, torment. So that's an obstacle. We all have that. Okay. So, oh sure, torment. This is actually from the monument to Cuauhtémoc in Mexico City, where the Spaniards are torturing Mr. Cuauhtémoc to tell us where is the gold. So, you know, it's still there. So the doubts. This is an image from one of the funeral sculptures they make in Bali. And you have Lucre making money, which is from a poster for a lottery in Mexico. When they change the new pesos to something else, they knock. So you have doubts about money. Who doesn't? And then aspirations. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Ah, that's a good one. Phew. Friendship, which is from Dr. Aboum's garden in Singapore.
Ooh,
that's lovely. Lovely little ladies waving in skimpy bathing suits. The desires, oh my. Now this is used to be a cultural institution in San Francisco. She no longer has it. Is that what I used to call the best pee in town. It's Marilyn Monroe at What's it called? I'll think of it in a minute. So the desire is introspection. Now, there is a difference between an aspiration and desire, which want to be, and a desire is more of a body thing.
What was that?
Oh, introspection. It's from a, this is, it's from Hamlet, you know, he's looking at the thing. It's work, or, you know, I forget what the line is. But it's from a medical building in San Francisco. And the way to achieve whatever is going to be achieved, the vehicle, which is a sculpture of a Buddha in Thailand, is destiny. From Portland, Oregon, we get just the destiny. So we got off easy. Thank you. So come look.
10 minutes.
So basically, that's it.
We have some time for some questions. They can do that too.
I always have questions. The first image that you showed us that sticks with me is the one of the archaeological photographs that you took.
Right.
Now, was that assembled and presented that way?
No. I just use that for.
And why at night? Why did you have to go at night?
Because we were photographing with flash, and we had to beat the sun.
Because it was so hot?
Because there was so much light. And also, it was, during the day, it's hot. You know, that area, it's hot.
And so when were those taken?
That was 81. Oh. 81. That was 81, of that one in particular, no, that was... the season of 82, which the season there you work in the dry season, so it was probably fall. It was before Christmas or after Christmas. I really can't remember. It was just before I came up to the United States that time. It was an interesting experience. We, as you know, the tropics is a hard place to work in. You get ill very easily. But we finally. The guy we worked with finally convinced the authorities to house us in a Villas Arqueológicas. Have you ever been to Chichén? There's this hotel that is a partnership between the French government and the Mexican government. And the place was run by an ex-foreign legion. Spotless. He had little caps on his boots, on his shoes, and you could hear him. And everybody scurried. And with the place was spotless, we never got sick after eating that. So we walk into the jungle carrying our little French cakes and stuff. And so it was and that end was fun. But it was long. Buggy nights.
So a piece like Lotería there, based on tarot, right?
Based on?
On the tarot.
First the Lotería, the Mexican Lotería. And then I tried to do a tarot.
So yeah. A tarot, yes. So as the creator of which kind of begs interaction, how do you see it used in libraries? A showpiece only?
There is a way to exhibit this. I created this little device that allows you to do it. Ultimately, it would be great to do a little interactive little app with your telephone and be able to, or something where you could, you know, you could play the game without having to handle the merchandise.
So do you see a user coming into like special collections where this is housed? Do you see somebody, you know, coming in and
using it?
Well, that's, I would love that they actually did, you know, they could, you know. But it's, a librarian would freak out by the me shuffling them, you know.
I was getting anxious while
yeah, yeah. I did it very carefully, you know. Mine, the one I have, is all well worn, you know. But yeah, it makes it a difficult situation, you know. And I think at this point, you know, it is being where it is and what it is. It's just the look, and then the interaction. Well, maybe you can have a video of it, or we could do an interactive.
Do you
know.
You see yourself doing that? Doing or the app or something?
With my bandwidth right now, I'll be more than, you know, I do parties and. yeah, the different things. I'll bring my own deck, because again, it's not only. It goes into the interpretation. You know, it's. I can pick up on things, I can make a joke, I can try to disarm a difficult situation. I've had people who drew 5 negative cards, and that is a difficult place to be. You know, you go, okay, dude, go home, take an aspirin, call me in the morning. Because, and if you start asking, it's really uncanny how sometimes it does allow that to things to come out that are not normal, you know, normally share. So that, how do you package that? No, you can't, you know. The stories, it's very difficult. It would be interesting to make a little game, you know. But again, you know, platforms change so quickly, you know, the operating system will last, you're lucky, 2 years, and then it's obsolete. You know, this which happens with all this computer stuff, you know.
I'm okay with pen and paper, so you can write that out.
Yeah, I will write it out. Yeah, but how can you really, you know, I'd have to write a tome that big. You know? It would be great, but that's it. Exhibiting has been a challenge. I've had them swiped from museums. They've disappeared. It's been a challenge getting the insurance for that, but. But there is a way. I have these little plastic holders that a friend of mine designed, and they go in cases. There's 3 cases, and you can put them all, and there's the middle ones, or you put them in the middle, and they all have this thing, and it's closed, and you can't play it, which is too bad. Maybe you could make Xeroxes or something, you know, to play with. It's a challenge, you know. What do you do with this? You know? That's what's nice about the actual books, the other ones, that you can handle them a little bit better and they survive a bit better. Yeah. This is, I would not worry too much about these getting dinged. These are heavily varnished. That's something I made sure that we could do when I created the digital version. They have 3 coats of varnish so they can be handled without them getting grubby.
I was wondering if you could comment on the use of appropriated either sculptures or materials and how that, rather than creating original, using original work, but taking that appropriation to be able to craft content, the role that plays.
Well, I'm lazy. Also, you know, but it's basically what I use is an alphabet that's out there. So I'm writing within a found alphabet. You know, so the appropriation is just stuff that I find. You know, we make it, and I use it. That to me, that's my alphabet. That's what I do. That. That one, how did I get there? Well, it took a long time. And I think it was mostly, It came from inside of me with a bit of maturity, non-judgmental, finding empathy, learning to connect with empathy. Empathy is a difficult one. When you're young, or at least when I was young, it was not something that was at the tip of my fingers. Now I have lived and I've seen a little bit more, and I think I have a lot more empathy than I did before. You know, I've been kicked around, so it's, you learn. And that took 20 years. And then the poetry, this writing has never been easy for me. It's getting a little easier now. The poetry came, well, basically it was just, so let's write it down and drink a, you know, had a good dinner, a good bottle of Cabernet, and laid it out. Like that, a half an hour, 10, 15 minutes, the poems were done. And then it took me 2 or 3 days to correct them. The layout took a while. I mean, that layout is a very complicated layout. The way I describe it is not a polite way, but it was very complicated. But it was great fun. You know, you need quiet. You need a time where you can just lock yourself up. And the best time for me, well, those was when my daughter and my wife would go away and I'd stay home. You know, I'd wake up in the morning, have coffee and turn on some Bach or something like that, establish some order through. I am very inspired by music. Music is essential to me. And with that, I establish order. And then I can go crazy. But I need my Bach, my Beethoven. So it takes time. You know, find your voice takes time. And you just got to listen to it. You listen to yourself.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming.